I was buzzed off red wine. It had been a perfect evening, but I was racing against time. It was 9 p.m. and verging on summer, the season of extended curfew. Still, it was not quite summer, and dusk was ticking through the sky. By the time the pink sunset started turning gray, I was 6 bus stops away from home. I counted the stops. My heart pounded. I felt like I was racing against something as light-sensitive as vampires, like Lestat would be waiting for me if I arrived after 9:30. I heard once that vampires are metaphors for sexual violence. They too are coming for your bare neck. Why didn't I plan ahead? I arrived home safe that night. I speedwalked to my front door as the last streaks of light left the sky, and I felt like I had cheated fate, like my life was final destination. Looking back on it now, I just wonder, why do I do this to myself? Is there some inherent flaw in me that's made me react this way? There's such a drastic quality to my fear, letting one encounter affect thousands of evenings afterward. There's something so naive about insisting that daylight makes a difference. Why do I imagine that violence wears a wristwatch? A friend of mine recently described being followed home by a strange van. The van sped off when a police car passed by. "It was scary, but I'm all right," she insisted. "I still think this is a safe city, and I'm not about to need someone to walk me home now." She sounded determined, if somewhat unconvinced. She sounded angry and steadfast. I am not steadfast. Why? Is it because my mother keeps a bread knife in her sock drawer? Is it because, when my father's out of town, my lovely, paranoid mother locks all the windows in the house shut with climbing carabiners? I come from a family that believes in booby traps. We MacGyver against the boogeyman. Maybe terror is passed down in the genes. I've always been anxious. I've been hooked to anxiety with one of my mother's carabiners. Is that funny? I want my fear to be funny. Listen, it's funny that I've contemplated using static guard as a weapon. But if there's comedy here, it's grim comedy. I am embarrassed of it. I am embarrassed of the way I've let my fear change me. There was another encounter, 4 years after the first masturbator. It was at a nude beach. I'd just been swimming, my first time going for an evening dip with fellow students from my university residence. My friend and I were climbing out of the water when we spotted a man masturbating nearby. A few of our friends were still swimming. The man was sitting on a rock. He looked so casual, half bored with his movements, as if stirring risotto. He was pretending to read a magazine. It looked like The Walrus. Who violates women while reading The Walrus? Maybe, I thought, he didn't even know he was masturbating. Maybe he had a neurological condition and believed he was gently scratching an arm. But he did know. He must have, because he wore a smug half-smile, a barely visible curl in his cheek. I watched it as if in scientific study. I forced myself to stare at his crinkled balls. I decided that I would let a number of variables for the situation determine my reaction. If he was masturbating at the general idea of a nude beach, rather than at my friends and me specifically, I did not need to be scared. If he was masturbating at me and all my friends, i.e., not just me, I did not need to be scared. Even if he was masturbating at me, as long as we didn't make eye contact, I did not need to be scared. These phony variables empowered me. I toweled off and pulled on my shorts. "Gross," my friend said. "Let's get out of here." Our other friends were still bobbing in the water, framed by the perfect sunset like some cheesy oil painting. I was on one of the most beautiful campuses in the world, and there was a man jerking off 6 feet to my left. And I was displeased, but I was not scared. What can account for the discrepancy between the first masturbator and the second? Someone explain the math to me. Why do some encounters change a person when others do not? Why do some encounters change one person, but not another? I imagine a quiz. Hierarchy of Trauma, Public Masturbation Edition. Were you alone when you saw the man? Did the man masturbate or just expose himself? If he masturbated, did you see cum? Did he say something cryptic while he masturbated? Did he say something benign? Was the incident in your neighborhood? Have you previously been described as unflappable? Have you previously been described as chicken shit? When you don't walk alone at night, you are safe. You are safe, you are safe, you are safe. You are safe from men in sweatpants, each with one hand around his penis. You are safe from that other man who once trailed you home, forcing you to run fast and slam your apartment door behind you. You are safe from the ponytailed gawker who, just a week ago, rode past you on a bike and yelled, "I'd have that for lunch." You are also safe from the man who ordered a pussy burger from you at your high school job. Why do you still remember how his tongue pointed when you stuck it out? You are safe from any man who's ever thought you were food. From anyone who ever thought you were a resource, less than human, available for theft. And because you believe you are safe, you must admit complicity to a faulty logic. When you don't walk alone at night, you don't get raped. You hate this logic. This logic skews blame and ignores reality. And yet you must believe it, because this logic accounts for your caution. This logic has shaped your behavior. This logic is part of the problem, but you wear it as protection. It is a dangerous kind of double thinking, a face-off between understanding and fear. When you don't walk alone at night, you think a lot about contradictions. Still 5 years after, and counting. I'm living back in my hometown again, in a new neighborhood now. Recently, I took the train to visit my parents, and I rode past that old platform. And, like I do every time I pass it, I looked at the bushes, half expecting to see someone standing there. I waited for the flash of skin between leaves, for the realization of a body where a body shouldn't be. The station has lost any sense of familiarity it once held for me. It is someone I once knew, who has since grown cold to me. There have been thousands of nights since that night. Some of them, I've been at home. Others, I've been out and about, awaiting the moment when I'll have to leave. When I'll be, once again, caught in the space between two perceived safeties. Not home, then home. Not safe, then safe. I think about that imagined in-between, because I don't know how to stop thinking about it. It's a lie I can't talk myself out of. That night on the train platform remains unflinchingly recent. It is of the past, but immune to nostalgia. Where does it end? I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether there's a breaking point, and after that, a seeking of counsel, and finally a healthier way of coping. I don't know at what point habit becomes unsustainable. I just know it's been 5 years now, and I still don't listen to that Bonnie Prince Billy album. I got rid of that black t-shirt, and I never wait for a train without remembering.
Why I Didn't Say No by Alyssa Bassist. Because I thought love and sex were supposed to hurt. Because my favorite author in high school was Ayn Rand. Because women have been going through the ringer for true love and hot sex stretching back to cuneiform. Because of how attractive the straight white knights in fairy tales come off, the ones who exalt and heal distressed damsels after degrading and breaking them, and of how relatable the degraded, exalted, broken-heeled women are once they've submitted themselves, body and brain, to great men. Because I was watching my back for real rape and avoided fraternity-sponsored spring break booze cruises and walking alone while scantily clad at sinister times of night in foreign neighborhoods' back alleys. Because we met cute a la rom-com, a striking anti-hero and a double-decade virgin cross paths in the backyard of a house party, and later on, through the unnatural and unexplainable, fall in love. A love demonstrated by grand gestures, plagued with conflict marked by sexual difference, and reinforced by moments of choice. Because that fall Friday evening junior year of college, I saw him balanced on top of a concrete cylindrical pipe, and when he jumped down, he stood next to me and watched as other partygoers tried to do the same but couldn't, and I near sprained myself from yearning. His epic act, my tortoiseshell glasses. "You must skate or surf," I said, to impress him, but he ignored my siren song. Because I was ready to crucify myself over this boy for whom I would wait forever and ever for an answer, for a glance, for a scrap, for him to rescue or destroy or define me. Because after a delay, he said, "Both." How charming! Because I couldn't tear myself away, though he had left. Because we re-met cute the next spring when a friend and I went to the playground near the freshman dorms, and notorious stoners who ran the university radio station were also there. Because I sat on a swing and was in the air when he, the skater slash surfer who could have been a model slash actor in a toothpaste slash vodka commercial, approached my swing and said, "Hey," like a touch from God. Because I was breathless. Because he was breathtaking. Because soon I worked out his schedule, learned his routine by heart, and knew where he'd be and when he'd be there so that I could be there too, dressed sacrificially. Because the next time I saw him, at another party, this time encircled by a blonde girl halo, I sauntered over to him and delivered the line I'd rehearsed. "Remember me? From the swings?" Because he remembered. Because when we first kissed, we kissed until sunrise, until there was steam on our clothes. Because he and I made out again, and then again, also again, additionally again, until one morning, recovering from gymnastic dry humping, I realized, a la romantic comedian Emma Bovary, I have a lover, and he's a slutty DJ with a longboard and a six-pack of both beer and stomach muscle. Because I wanted to be his girlfriend, and because I would have settled for being his waitress. Because when our senior year was underway, he told me that he didn't want to have uncommitted, unspecific someone brainless slut sex anymore. That he'd gotten it out of his system, that he'd spurn all other girls for me. Because I was terrifically excited to notch my spotless bedpost, to be intimate with him. Because in the sexual debut of my mind's eye, I'd concurrently discover and execute the maneuvers of a soft core seduction that prefaced what would resemble a physical struggle, a catalog of spiritual sexual practices, some standing. A parade of romantic lechery. We'd give everything of ourselves and take everything of the other. We'd get lost unto it, searching each other's bodies in a carnal interrogation that would most likely ignite a blind fury. Fervid, raw, athletic, durational, demonic, transformational, professional. He'd possess me, and I'd surrender out of strength as my gift. And yield to him as he bore through my flesh, passion all unbridled until at some point I begged for mercy, seared to the bones, ravaged, and I'd collapse next to him on the God-willing, unbroken bed, our designed for each other limbs entwined in damp sheets, and trembling, we lie together post-coitally for hours, emptied, undone, our unquenchable hunger quenched. Because, in a nutshell, I figured I was in store for some crazy fucking. Because I had anticipated some initial agony, but thought it would, over time, be rewarded with tons of ecstasy, like the first sex scene in The Fountainhead that I'd read at 18 when I registered a heartbeat south of my heart as Howard Roark took Dominique Franken by force. Because I was well-rounded and also read Cosmopolitan. Because I could flip to any page in the aughts and find tips and tricks that promised we can all be beautiful if only we learn to give a better blowjob. Because of more advice to surrender sexually and to accept the double standard that a man's pleasure is fundamental to his well-being and hers optional or non-applicable. Because almost always the number one goal was to nimbly accommodate and satisfy your man by indulging his uncontrollable primal biological urges. Because women like me get guidance of the wazoo regarding what men want and how we can give it to them. Because the self-not-helping formula of media aimed at women sells sex as the end-all, be-all, empowerment through disempowerment, and self-improvement via self-destruction. Because I wanted to have, or to be perceived as having, a bomb-ass pussy. Because growing up, beyond Rand and Cosmo, I was exposed almost exclusively to male narrators and protagonists, and found myself inside the male mind, championing his desires and aligning with his frustrations. Because I'd think, give the man sex. My thoughts indistinguishable from his. He needs to have sex, I'd tell myself, merging obsessions and assuming, as many do, that hot, hardcore, superlative sex was his God-given right. Because I was indoctrinated to the point that I demonized my own resistance for getting in between what he needed and how he wanted it. Because anyone who gets in between is, by default, wrong, withholding, and unfun. Because what was important to him became the only important thing. Because most of what I knew about myself, about history, the future, Earth, came from his POV. Because I hadn't yet read film theorist Laura Mulvey, who called out traditional storytelling in cinema marked by a certain split. Men are the subject while women are the spectacle, a sight to be seen and not heard. And so without a voice and without a story, and defined in terms of her relationships with men, and so without independence or agency, which, without even green screen technology, dehumanizes her. Because real life women internalize all this from the moment we first turn on a TV and learn how to read, then we make it our filter, our mythology and philosophy and religion, our every other thought and basis for interaction. Because we're porous, susceptible to anything. Because we are surrounded with 24/7 access to text, images, and audio that inflate and distort what we think of as love, sex, and gender, with the histrionic and pathological, the inexplicable and unattainable, the misogynistic and incomplete. Because first our thoughts reshape, next our emotions, then our behaviors, finally our identities and view of life itself. Because my boyfriend and I were born, we grew up, we'd been appropriated into the milieu, and because as special as my parents told me I was, no one deftly eludes media's teeth. As Rebecca Solnit put it, the elephant in the room is the room itself. Because of the trap that one is inevitably in. A man pulls a woman's hair. Likely, he once saw an actor pull an actress's hair, and the actress gasped in pleasure. So he pulls and she gasps. Maybe she gasps in pleasure, or in pain, or because she's seen something too, or has had a legacy shoved down her throat before she could learn what she desires, or because she wants to be normal. But a gasp is a gasp is a gasp. And maybe he thinks it's kosher to then choke her. So he pulls or chokes and she gasps in an attempt to experience sexuality and to fulfill the expectation, regardless of if she's enjoying herself as long as she's performing enjoyability. Because maybe, eventually, she pulls her own hair to please him. Because audiences assimilate these oft-interchangeable cinematic and societal scripts, the principles that represent and reflect the ruling ideology, and then echo them in united agreement without asking why. because media have colonized everything from social dynamics to intimate moments. Because media often present intercourse violently and violation as fundamental to its eroticism. Because of our appetite for drama and our desensitization to damage. Because we learn how to have sex from someplace. Because even personal singular desire is a product of environment. Because my behavior and word choice were a convergence of marketed cliches of how women are supposed to act and sound in sexual scenarios. Because I knew how to say, yes, harder, in 1,000 languages. I knew how to moan in 8 octaves, how to bend over backward, how to ask for it, how to beg God for it, but not how to say no, stop. Because instead I told him, using adjectives like slow and soft and deliberate, what I wanted, what I learned in women and gender studies courses works for women, which in practice wasn't a preternational frenzy, but to be kissed and licked crazily, him down on his knees for me and his mouth on my thighs, his hands going all in and around me. Because he could be tender. Because I could be seduced and secure. Because everything could be playful and steamy, and he could get me all the way off with devoted fingers. Because everything I'd learned in advanced contemporary female sexualities, like that when a woman is turned on, her brain sends messages to the back of the vagina to expand and loosen, and to the cervix and uterus to pull back and lift to high heaven to allow room for the penis, or dildo, or whatever your pleasure, readying her for sex, and that this arousal is what thirst is to drinking, seemed as out of reach for real-life application as Chaucer or differential geometry. Because in class, I could rattle off the 7 erogenous zones at breakneck speed, inner thighs, nipples, nape of the neck, lips, ears, butt, clit. But it was the classic, I can talk the talk but not fuck the fuck dilemma. Because I couldn't talk the talk either. Because even if I knew better, even I didn't know better. Because intellect can miss the gospel of intuition. Because it's one of the more minor human tragedies, to know better and still. Because although I studied gender and sexuality as part of my degree, culture had called dibs on our psyches and souls. Because despite my entreaties and my liberal arts education and his short-lived tenderness, he'd work into his factory-setting rhythm, fast and hard in every which way that stylized women scream they want it, and I'd be beneath him, pinned down, hurting, but hoping, but cringing, but hoping, while he'd pound and grind against me and I couldn't say anything. Because all I could do was hold on, stare at him, and focus on the bond between me and some guy no longer aware of me. Because when I cried, sometimes he'd say, "Should I keep going?" And in my head, I screamed, "No, stop!" But it came out quiet and ragged, as if ripped out, and like this. Keep going. So he did. Because when a question seems to have a single answer, then you supply that answer, even if you don't mean it. Because after, we spooned on warm sheets and said, "I love you," and meant it. Because you know how you think of what to say once you've walked away? Because you know how the words they want to hear can be the only words we know how to say? Because at times it seemed the only word I knew was his name. Because telepathy might be a thing. Because I wanted him to want to stop without me having to ask, to know without being told, to take crying as a sign, to be a hero and come to my rescue. Because I settled for him to keep going, to show his love for me like this. Because when he said he loved me the first time, facing me under what was most likely pale moonlight, Somewhere trumpets blared, confetti exploded, doves cried. Above us, a chorus of angels sang hallelujah, and my heart ejaculated. Because love had an analgesic effect, and my empathy reached a pitch where if sex felt good to him, then it felt good to me. Although at times it really felt like I wouldn't survive it. Because love's a temple, a higher law, a psychosis, an addiction, a supernatural and socially constructed biological necessity and eternal torture. Because you always hurt the one you love. Because I was supposed to love the way it hurt. Because the cult of love in the West is an aspect of the cult of suffering, Susan Sontag wrote. Because in the Fountainhead, I'd underlined this. Dominique found a dark satisfaction in pain, because that pain came from him. Because in Atlas Shrugged, alpha male Francisco Danconia tells railroad company VP Dagny Taggart that she sounds happy in her new relationship. But, you see, the measure of the hell you're able to endure is the measure of your love. Because I believed I would have died for him, so I would have done a lot less than that for him, too. Because there wasn't anything I wouldn't do for love. Because in our no pain, no gain dogma, the cost of something is often mistaken for its value. Because I decided that what I felt was probably whatever love is. Because I couldn't let that love die. Because love rewards the optimistic and punishes those who vocalize their fury. At first, we had sex despite my pain. Months later, we still did. Because women are bred for pain, for giving birth when birth splits us open. Because we learn to live with it. Because we learn to live for it. Sontag again. It is not love which we overvalue, but suffering. Because rom-coms train us that if we suffer enough, then everything works out. Because I wanted to be a good sport and not make a big deal. Because I sucked it up and powered through. Because when he'd complain his hand hurt doing what I'd wanted him to do, I was busy saying, don't worry about it, and he didn't. Because I didn't want to ruin his experience of me. Because bad sex was on me. Because sex that feels out of one's control is called bad sex, disappointing sex, regrettable sex, phrases that take on a myriad of meaning that pervert meaning. Because I knew I was being ranked on how good I gave it and how well I took it. Because when I went to a gynecologist, she brought out a medical device that she called a vaginal dilator, and when she lubed it up and inserted the stiff, opaque, medical-grade silicone, I went momentarily blind. But I took the smallest one home with me anyway and let the cloudy white thinger lifelessly dangle in me nightly for 10 to 15 minutes, while I watched Family Guy or played soft instrumental folk CDs. Because whatever was wrong could be solved, possibly, by starting my last semester in college with a prescription Go Stick. Because the next gynecologist recommended more sex. Because my boyfriend agreed, using the practice makes perfect line of this isn't my problem thinking. Because it seemed as liberated, educated, non-religious women were urged to have lots of sex, great sex, whatever sex, sex like a straight guy, but not no sex. Because it's now more of a public disgrace and bodily phenomenon to be prude than promiscuous. Because I wanted to be a whore for him. Because unless women become better in bed, we implode. Because I'd remind myself that he was my boyfriend. My boyfriend. My boyfriend. Because I questioned myself and my sanity and what I was doing wrong in this situation. Because of course I feared that I might be overreacting, over-emotional, oversensitive, weak, playing victim, crying wolf, blowing things out of proportion, making things up. Because generations of women have heard that they're irrational, melodramatic, neurotic, hysterical, hormonal, psycho, fragile, and bossy. Because girls are coached out of the womb to be non-confrontational, solicitous, deferential, demure, nurturing, to be tuned into others, and to shrink and shut up. Because speaking up for myself was not how I learned English. Because I'm fluent in apology, in question mark, in giggle, in bowing down, in self-sacrifice. Because slightly more than half of the population is regularly told that what happens doesn't, or that it isn't the big deal we're making it into. Because your mothers, sisters, and daughters are routinely second-guessed, blown off, discredited, denigrated, besmirched, belittled, patronized, mocked, shamed, gaslit, insulted, bullied, harassed, threatened, punished, propositioned, and groped, and challenged on what they say. Because when a woman challenges a man, then the facts are automatically in dispute, as is the speaker and the speaker's license to speak. Because as women, we are told to view and value ourselves in terms of how men view and value us, which is to say, for our sexuality and agreeability. Because it was drilled in until it turned subconscious and became unbearable need. Don't make it about you. Put yourself second or last. Disregard your feelings, but not another's. Disbelieve your perceptions whenever the opportunity presents itself. Run and rerun everything by yourself before verbalizing it. Put it in perspective. Interrogate it. Do you sound nuts? Does this make you look bad? Are you holding his interest? Are you being considerate? Fair? Sweet? Because stifling trauma is just good manners. Because when others serially talk down to you, assume authority over you, try to talk you out of your own feelings and tell you who you are, when you're not taken seriously or listened to in countless daily interactions, then you may learn to accept it, to expect it, to agree with the critics and the haters and the beloveds, and to sign off on it with total silence. Because they're coming from a good place. Because everywhere from late-night TV talk shows to thought-leading periodicals to Hollywood to Silicon Valley to Wall Street to Congress and the current administration, women are drastically underrepresented or absent, missing from the popular imagination and public heart. Because although I questioned myself, I didn't question who controls the narrative, the show, the engineering, or the fantasy, nor to whom it's catered. Because to mention certain things like patriarchy is to be dubbed a feminazi, which discourages its mention. And whatever goes unmentioned gets a pass that condones what it isn't nice to mention, lest we come off as reactionary or shrill. Because he'd make me grilled cheese at 3 a.m., and I'd get him 5 tacos on Taco Tuesdays, and once, when I was sick, he delivered a single white rose, a plain buttered bagel, my favorite, and a card with a bulldog wearing an ice pack, where inside he wrote that I was his favorite. Because when I said I didn't want to have sex, he didn't talk to me for the rest of the night. Because when I would plead, he would plead. My panic, his smile. Because I preferred not to fight or appear culpable. Because I'd lie. It's fine, I'd say, desperate, like I could choose another sensation, dispel the anxiety through a sleight of psyche and keep on loving him. Because lying is just performing, and perform is what we're encouraged to do. Because besides, even if I'd said, no, stop, there are those who'd think I meant, yes, please, anyway. Because I was at a loss for even the wrong words. Because words escape us, they fail us, they miss. Because I woke up one night to him hard and upon me from behind, jabbing me, my vagina, my heart, my threshold. And I said, "What the?" semi-asleep. "What the?" And he said, "Don't be mad," as warm semen trickled down my inner thighs, coating and staining them. Because I didn't know what to call that. Still, I slept beside him almost every night until graduation, willingly, just because. Because! Grilled cheeses at 3 a.m., Taco Tuesdays, bulldogs wearing ice packs. Because I remember leaving Student Health Services and passing black and white posters of a group of Resolve faces underneath a statistic in large, bold red font. 1 in 4 college women experiences sexual violence. And thinking, what a god-awful statistic that has nothing at all to do with me, a woman in love. Because I told my friends, on the rare occasion I saw them, we're violently in love. Because what you call art, or superficial distraction, or clickbait, is alive and haunted and an ideological weapon of mass self-destruction. Because I didn't inquire, what are the power structures operating here? And opted to believe that consent is an individual, uncomplicated yes-no articulation and action. Because even after I'd read preeminent scholar activist feminists, if my boyfriend said he loved me while hurting me, then I'd consent to be hurt. Because beggars can't be choosers. Because you could say it was a choice, one muddled by inculcation, mood, altruistic deceit, fear, insecurity, risk, cornering, the chaos of the heart, and free will. Because I didn't want to entertain the idea that there was anything going on that should have to be contested and stopped. Because although it takes a while to nail those sex tips worth trying, it takes longer to figure out what's not okay. Because who fantasizes about ethical sex? About moral principles that govern a group's behavior? Because instead, at times, I wished he'd hit me so that I'd have an ironclad justification to find a curb and kick him to it. To say it. Because there are some things I have to say only to know I don't mean them. Because I could still get weak-kneed around him. Because I was more afraid to go untouched. Because girls are cruelest to themselves, writes Anne Carson in the Glass essay. Because I didn't, and so he didn't. Because he didn't want to hear it. Because then we'd have to discuss it, and if we discussed it, then we'd have to discuss everything else. Rape culture, masculinity, gender inequality, femininity, patriarchy, complicity. And who wants to get into that? Because women who get hurt or humiliated on a smaller scale in broad daylight persistently is non-news or non-newsworthy. Because amid pandemic, most are voiceless. Because sidelining women's stories, voices, visages, and also glorifying, thus neutralizing their suffering, are not only prerequisites to sexual violence against women, but also ensure that sexual violence isn't seen as sexual violence, but as totally normal, sanctioned behavior. Because saying it out loud wasn't even the solution. Because we didn't even say, it's over. We allowed post-graduation distance to do its work. Or I should say he emailed me confessing that he'd cheated 5 times with 4 different women while we were together and I'd worried I might have had syphilis. Because life can be this way, unexplained by sad songs. Because his now wife would say he's a good guy, with a human heart who doesn't even watch rom-coms or read about libertarianism. Because when a third gynecologist asked me when I'd given birth, and when I went pale and told her, no, stop, truly, I'd never been pregnant, and when she said that my cervix was shredded and looked like I had, even then, when the pain was not just an experience or theatrics, when acknowledgement imposed proof of force and proof was somehow necessary, even after fucking Eureka, even with the truth inflicted, what was there to say? Because the doctor said to herself, wow, and didn't offer much beyond the explanation that the tear he tore continued to rip the more he had sex with me. And as she finished the exam, she said, you'll feel some more pressure. But I didn't feel anything. Not for 2 years. Because I wasn't sure when I went from thinking I was having sex to thinking I was being had sex with. Because love and sex left me as my entertainment said and I'd hoped it would. Passion shattered. Because worst case scenario is murder. Oh, because it wasn't that bad.
This is Roxane Gay. Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture, was directed and executive produced by Suzanne Mitchell and produced by John Marshall Media. Compilation and introduction copyright 2018 by Roxane Gay. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.